أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آله I'm sure you have built up a very solid knowledge about the way marja'iyya or this whole methodology of ijtihad started, and then the history of big scholars, and also the history of maraji and universal maraji, because universal marja was something rather new to Shia world due to communication and such things, which came about in about 18th, 19th century. One issue which we are going to mainly focus in these two lectures is somehow detrimental to the knowledge that you have already gained, in the sense that I'm somehow going to blow up some of the things that you have learned up till now, and in a sense confuse you a little bit, just to get a flavor. Just to get a flavor of how our ulama are struggling to find the way forward in the issue of marja'iyya and ijtihad. Now, ijtihad has two parts. One part is to find out what the Prophet exactly did, sunnah. Because ijtihad is to find out what is the sunnah. Now, even when we refer to Imams, alayhim as-salam, in their hadith, we refer to it because we find it a more reliable means to sunnah of the Prophet than the traditions of the companions, which are compiled later on, and we don't know how much of it is good, how much of it is useless. So, we do not refer to Imams, alayhim as-salam, as an independent source, because we think that their sunnah was something independent that Muslims should refer to. We believe that what they said and what they did is shedding light on the sunnah of the Prophet, is a more reliable means to the sunnah of the Prophet. So one aspect of ijtihad is always to find out how did Prophet, peace be on him, practiced in his sunnah with regards to ibadat, worship, with regards to mu'amalat, social issues. How did Prophet practice? This is one aspect of it. One aspect. This is the easiest aspect. Of course, when I say easiest, that doesn't mean it's easy. It's very difficult. You see how confusing the issue is and how confused the Muslims are. Because each school says that Prophet practiced in this way. But compared to the other side of ijtihad, which I'm going to talk about, and you have of course heard about it in your previous lectures, it is the easier part. The more difficult part is things that Prophet did not do because they were not around, because they did not exist at the time. And now we want to find out how would the Prophet, peace be on him, would have acted. This is a more hypothetical sort of part of ijtihad. We want to know what is the, when I say we want to know what is the Islamic rule about it, that means we want to know what is the sunnah of the Prophet. Now, what is the sunnah of the Prophet with regards to salat? Okay, that has been practiced already. What is the practice, the sunnah of the Prophet with regards to hajj? That's, of course, we can find out after a fashion, of course, with difficulty. However, what would have been the sunnah of the Prophet with regards to, say, for example, artificial insemination? That was not around at the time. We want to find out, hypothetically, what would have been the law if the Prophet, peace be on him, was around, what he would have ruled in this regard. Now, this is a more difficult part of ijtihad. And when we talk about ijtihad in the modern time, actually we are in need of this type of ijtihad more than, or this aspect of the ijtihad, more than the other aspect. I mean, what's the difference of the fatwa of Ayatollah Sistani and Ayatollah Makarem and Ayatollah Khomeini and Ayatollah Tabrizi, for example, with regards to Salat or some very trivial. Even, I tell you one thing, you may become a bit angry with me. Even if they were not around, we could have just referred to Sheikh Al-Ansari. Even if he was not around, we could have referred to Sheikh Tusi 10 centuries ago. Not much difference. Just go and see the rulings of Sheikh Tusi with regard to Salat and so, and the rulings of Ayatollah Sistani or Ayatollah Khomeini. Not much difference, actually. So, this is not that aspect of ijtihad which we say we need a mujtahid who is contemporary, who lives with us. It is not for that aspect of the ijtihad. It is for this other aspect of ijtihad. And this makes the role of mujtahid very important, actually. That's okay, there are issues and problems that we cannot find anywhere. There is nothing in the fatwa of past ulama about it, and now we want to find out what to do. For example, drug trafficking. Drug trafficking. You never can see such a thing in old books. Okay? But now we rule and we actually punish heavily drug traffickers, isn't it? We execute them. We didn't have this before. We didn't have such ruling or such an issue at all, drug trafficking. So the important thing is that we need the mujtahideen of our time to tell us what should we do regarding the issues which were not previously discussed by previous ulama and were not existing at the time of the Prophet. So this is the more difficult aspect of ijtihad. Now, when you come to this, I'm sure we have explanations for this, isn't it? I mean, theoretically, it's very easy. Theoretically, okay, the A'imma have given us the usul, main principles, and from those main principles, you find out the furu', isn't it? Alayna ilgha'ul usul, wa alaykum tafri'ul furu'. We give you the principles, and you find out what are the furu', or the different branches of ruling, different fields of social life, you find out. Well, principally or theoretically, it's very easy to say. But when we come to practice, well, it's very difficult because some of these issues is related to our economy. Some are related to medical ethics. Some are related to social justice. And so on and so forth. And that's why I have chosen the title, Can One Man Tackle? I mean, in old days, one man could tackle all the issues of ijtihad because we didn't have this proliferation of issues. It was almost the same for several centuries. But since the last couple of centuries, we have this proliferation of issues coming forth. And therefore, we have to think, is this method of ijtihad that we are using today, is this sufficient? Is this instrumental to find the correct ruling of the hypothetical situation that if Prophet was around, what would he had ruled in the situation? Now, I want you to hear from you. What do you think? Now, put aside all your religious prejudice and your marja prejudice and all these things. And tell me what you think. I mean, as an individual who is following a Maja, do you think one person can tackle? And then I want to mention history behind it, and you will be amazed how in Hausa they have tried to tackle this, and what big personalities have been somehow sacrificed for putting forward new ideas. Okay? Now, I want to sacrifice you first, and then we'll go to big Hausa personalities to see what they yes.
I think one person can tackle all these issues, but I think that one person has to be living in the same place that you're living in, to experience the same things that you're experiencing, to go through the same things you're going through. They've been brought up in that environment. And then I think, yes, that one person can adjudicate, if you like, on all kinds of issues.
On medical ethics, on economy, on banking, on what do you call it? For example, international maritime laws, on laws of how we have to somehow tackle the space or manage the space. Can one person actually do all this? And these are very different fields, isn't it? Isn't it?
Yes. First, to answer your question, can one person just as highlighted?
Yeah.
I think what we are, what I feel is making us think that we need more than one person is because predominantly the Maraja that we have been following are based in either Iraq or in Iran or in Lebanon. We don't
I interrupted. Exactly these same problems exist in Iran and Iraq.
No, I'm coming to my point.
Yeah.
So if we had a Maraja like the Aga Khan who is freely traveling everywhere, we would feel more comfortable to follow one person because we feel that he's having
this. That's a new Maja, huh?
No. The point being that because he is their spiritual leader and because he moves around the world freely,
yeah,
therefore he can easily get access to information which we feel, sitting here, that our Maraja may not be getting that information on financial matters, etc., because they also may not be happening in where they're living. It is more active in this part of the world, if you like, in the Western part.
Okay.
So we feel that if our Maraja was traveling around, one would be sufficient. But because they're restricted, we feel that they have to have either a committee or we have to have the freedom to follow on certain matters other Maraji.
Yes.
Can I ask how many of our current outstanding Maraji would know how to use a computer?
Well, I don't know. I haven't lived with them. But knowing how to use a computer, you know, the old scholars in every field, physics, chemistry, mathematics, they are not very well versed in computers, but they are very knowledgeable, okay? Computer is a modern thing, but computer doesn't give us knowledge. Computer is only a means. I mean, we have people who are quite equipped with all computer sort of capabilities. However, if you ask them about certain aspects of knowledge, actually, the computer, moreover, makes our knowledge very shallow because we just go to this website, that website, we take something from here, something from there. I don't think computer is an essential thing in that. It makes life much easier, if our Maraja use computer, their life would become much easier in terms of investigation, research. However, they are coping. I mean, they have coped without computer. As the science in itself, I mean, as a whole, has coped without computer. I mean, computer is a modern thing. We have several centuries of scientific history, and scientists have coped without computer. I don't think computer is a main issue. I don't know. Anyone really thinks that computer is really a main sort of factor even.
The point I was trying to make is that we should have some kind of system whereby our Maharaja are fully versed with all the latest scientific technological inventions.
Okay, that's very good that you have that such a high regard for Maharaja. But one really, can one human being be well versed in every field of science and knowledge and keep up to date? I mean, how many hours we have in a day and night? 24 hours, isn't it? I mean, can really one person do it? Just put aside our Maharaja. I mean, our Maharaja are very respectful people. Okay, however, very respected people. However, we are not talking about individuals. We are saying, can really one person know about all these things and keep up to date with all these things? Is it possible? Yes.
I'm just thinking, is it a retirement period for Maharajas? Because when they're old, it's difficult to keep up track with everything. So, would they die till the end, or is it when they retire?
You can look at it from that that side. How you can look at it from the wealth of experience and knowledge that they accumulate while they become older and older.
It's more difficult to acquire more knowledge because you're old and ill and sick.
Mm. You see, the marja'iyya is not something that you can keep just as a title. If other people come and excel you in your knowledge, younger people, they take it from you. Isn't it? You see? So, these Maharaja who become old, thanks to their diet or whatever, you see, they are very healthy. They don't go through this dementia or amnesia or things like that. So, as long as they are not somehow caught with such diseases, I think we have to use their wealth of experience and knowledge. Yes?
Just to say, I think one man can possibly do it all, because it's just like, how can one man run the country? How can one man be king and rule over, you know, his kingdom? But there will be, he might have a system of advisors or people who get that information, but it's about him and his wisdom and be able to make those decisions and, you know, see the straight path and see what is best for the people who are following him. So, he can be the ultimate decision maker, but not necessarily be an expert in every field.
But do we have this institution in our market? Do we have such an institution of a sort of systematized group of advisors advising the manager? No, we don't. We don't. And this is actually a good solution, isn't it? I mean, if we have one man, and in any sort of institution, eventually one man would decide, isn't it? However, we have different groups of advisors. Yes.
So, what Auntie mentioned, either it's Mutakri's forum or Ulama that stick together and essentially act as a marja, or if it's as itself, it's not unheard of within the system. But from what I understand, with the transgender issue that came up with Imam Khomeini, he went to doctors. And he went to other people who are versed in this to find out more before he reached a conclusion.
Yes.
So surely that's happening at the moment.
But that's not systematic. You see, of course, they seek advice of other people. However, that's not a systematic sort of institution. It's done randomly. It's done occasionally. And probably not efficiently. That's the problem. Yes, you want to say something? Yes.
I think following on from both points which have been mentioned, if I could look at it on an individual basis, let's say we were given a particular topic to handle, maybe to deliver a speech or whatever, we would do our utmost to try and get the research behind that topic before we presented it. Our ulamas and mujtahideen are responsible for whole world when they pass, when they adjudicate, when they pass the fatwa. So surely we should be having confidence in their ability to do the research on a given topic, whatever that may be, whether it be a science topic or whatever. They have the tools at hand like we do. They can go out there in the field and research that topic, refer to consultants, refer to specialists. And then only when they feel confident will they adjudicate on that. Because, as I said, they have a responsibility for adjudicating for the whole world as opposed to. So I feel that, you know, we need to have more confidence in their ability to adjudicate.
Okay.
Sure, I think it would be, I would say it would be better, I mean, it would be easier, the channels of communication were open more freely between us and them. If they were able to communicate more effectively with the Western countries, that might be something beneficial. But their ability to adjudicate, I don't think that's in doubt, because surely they have more tools at their disposal than we do as individuals.
Yeah. Now, let me give you a sort of different system. You tell me how you like this. Okay. For example, if we had one marja, which would have specialized only in economy, banking, finance, economy, having read all these economical theories, books, and how economy works around the world, that's enough for one, isn't it? I mean, and one mujtahid somehow excels in this. And when we want to follow the mujtahid, we see who should we follow? They say, in what field? They don't say, okay, follow that man or that man because he's alam. They say, in what field? In economy, this Ayatollah X. Okay. In medical ethics, Ayatollah Y. In social relations, politics, Ayatollah Z. What's wrong with this? Yes.
I'm not sure if this is wrong or not, but then how many categories do you come up with then?
As many as you need.
But it doesn't become too complicated. Because for every small thing, you have to go to, like, say, 20 different.
How do you actually find your way, your instructions, give you what you want? You go to different people, isn't it? I mean, if, for example, the government wants to create a policy on economy, they go to economists. If they want something about education, for example, they go to experts in education.
Is in that particular field?
Well, how do you know it in ordinary life? The same way people teach, people become experts, write, you look at their writings, and then you see that, for example, they are experts in that. Good. I mean, we have to actually investigate the problems. I mean, I tell you, there is one major problem that I will come to at the end for this theory. However, we have to somehow look into different aspects of this theory. Yes.
In such a system, what would happen when the boundaries between these two categories blur? So, when you're talking about someone who specializes in tax or inheritance, the fifth of that, somebody who specializes in medical ethics get together, and they disagree about the inheritance of a child conceived through artificial insemination.
You see their arguments.
So then do we have to pick which one is
no,
the particular issue? Or would they have to come to some sort of consensus? Or would there be some sort of court of appeal that they could go to? How would such a diffused system come to a conclusion when there is a blur between the relevant fields of expertise?
Yeah, this is one other problem, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, I think the notion of the idea that you have floated works when it's all in parallel lines.
Mm-hmm.
If it's only finance, it's only one line. I go to an accountant or I go to a tax consultant only to do with finance.
Mm-hmm.
The method you are saying is you have only one marja for that, but we are forgetting the principle Islamic values. The point is simple. So therefore it has to be one. And then if you have a team of experts, where we discussed the previous point, it would make more sense. Because the idea that Ali just mentioned is now, where you could have a blur sector. Here, if you have one, then the researcher is coming to the one at the end, and they say, well, looking at all the angles, your point, and then this is what the ruling should be.
Okay.
Because the point is Islam.
Okay. So you mean you agree with these different sort of groups of ijtihads, directed by the marja, by one person.
Yes.
And that's a good method, isn't it? That's a good model. Yes?
Just sort of widening the expertise in the sense of them having marja who are specializing in different fields. You could have intellectuals who are not necessarily Shia Rashidis, but not necessarily in the field of fiqh that they are mujtahids or alims, but they are in their own right, PhDs in economics or etc. And then the marja brings it together. The marja is more of a facilitator rather than the person himself.
You know what, you are actually coming to what I'm going to give as a theory later on. There was someone over there who wanted to say something. Okay. So, there is one other problem with this theory, and that is the political power of marja, isn't it? Especially in the Shia world, marja exerts huge political power. It's good. We need a center. We need a hub of political power. And if we have a marja, then it would be something which, if the power of leading the masses, leading the followers, is actually in the hand of one person, then when we confront the outside world, if there is a danger, we have more power than if we have two marja or three marja. Let me give you one example, which is a little bit of a sad example. Eventually it became very sad, but originally it was very good. When Ayatollah Hariri passed away in Qom, Ayatollah Hariri Yazdi, who actually re-established the Hawza in Qom. You know, Hawza in Qom was a very old Hawza. From the time of A'imma, Qom was the center of Shia learning. However, after the 4th, 5th century, it degenerated and somehow was destroyed completely. The center was shifted to Najaf. And from Baghdad also, it was shifted to Najaf. We had Baghdad, the most important place after Qom, or even better than Qom. We had huge ulama like Sheikh Mufid, Sayyid Murtaza, and others in Baghdad. But after the Qom somehow went through troubles, and Baghdad was somehow seized after the Buwayhis, who supported Shia ulama, it was seized by Seljuks. Then the center shifted to Najaf. Until the about 100 years ago, when Sheikh Hariri Yazdi came to Qom and established the Hawza again. Now, after he passed away, we didn't have a marja. We didn't have one marja. It was very important. Everyone actually looked up to Sheikh Hariri. There were three marja in Qom. Or three marja. Those of you who have been to Qom, of course, I know all of you have been to Qom, you find the tomb of all these three marja in above the tomb of Allama Tabatabai. It was Ayatollah Khunsari, Ayatollah Sa'd, and Ayatollah Hujjat. These two. And actually, the power of marja'iyya was divided. Now, they needed power. Why they needed power? Because they were actually fighting against a regime which was totally against religion. We needed power. Now, the ulama in the Qom thought that even these three marajah, they thought that this cannot go on like this. We need one marajah. Our people now cannot center around one marajah because we don't have that very excellent figure. And eventually they found that one marja in a very far away unknown city. And that was Burujerd in western Iran. Ayatollah Burujerd, he was a huge man in terms of his knowledge, his ability to lead, and Ayatollah Mutahhari, Ayatollah Muntazari, and others, they went during summer time, they went to Burujerd, they listened to him, they came back to Qom, they convinced Ayatollah Khomeini that he is the figure we are looking for. And Ayatollah Khomeini wrote to ulama in Iran, please, please convince Ayatollah Burujerdi to come to Bob. He was not interested. Just very easily, he wasn't interested. Until he was ill, he was taken to Tehran, to hospital, and there the ulama went to Tehran and they said, we would not allow you to go back to Burujerdi. You have to come to Bob. And eventually he accepted. Okay? He came to Bob, and Ayatollah Saad, who was an Ayatollah, a manager, he offered his place of teaching to him. All others supported him because they wanted one manager. Now, this is the problem that I talked about. If we have different manager, we lose power. Especially if we don't have a government or something like that. They wanted one manager. So they supported him. Ayatollah Khonsari supported him. Ayatollah Hujja supported him. Ayatollah Saad offered his own teaching place to him. And especially Ayatollah Khomeini. Although in political Ayatollah Khomeini was not very much pleased with the way Ayatollah Burujerdi wanted to lead the Shia community. However, he absolutely followed whatever he said. Because he, as he was very instrumental, he wrote letters to all places that we have to bring Ayatollah Burujerdi, we have to make this one marja as our marja, and he became the marja. Then, the sad part with both of us. Ayatollah Khomeini was thinking about a reshuffle of the system of Khomeini, a change in the system of Khomeini. Shahid Mutahhari was a student of Ayatollah Khomeini, closest to him. And he was somehow heralding the whole movement. We have to bring change. We have to somehow change the system of Marja'iyya into this council. He was talking about councils. We need councils, or we need, of course, at that time, Rafsanjani was very young, and of course, you know, young people are a bit quick in their decisions, and also they are very revolutionary. In his revolutionary sort of young age, he was saying that, no, we need marja in every field. One marja in this field, one marja in that field. Now, of course, Ayatollah Mutahhari was not that radical, but he was talking about these issues. And this, you know, there are always reactionary people. When you say something new, there are reactions. And they took, actually, the ideas of Mutahhari to Ayatollah Burujerdi, distorting what he was saying, that he wants to destroy the Hawza, he wants to destroy the system of Marja'iyya and all these things. And they said, Ayatollah Burujerdi thought that he is actually someone who is destroying the Hawza. And the man who was in the first place, who went to Burujerdi to bring Ayatollah Burujerdi, now he was somehow a point of anger of Ayatollah Burujerdi. And this was very sad for him, because he loved Ayatollah Burujerdi very much. He had put all his energy to make him the sole marja. He wrote him a letter that this is not the case. I mean, it's not the way that these people are bringing my opinions to you. I want to explain. However, things went wrong anyhow. And Ayatollah Mutahhari, for respect of Shahid Mutahhari, for respect of Ayatollah Burujerdi, he left home. He came to Tehran. And he says that my saddest days are when I had to leave Qom and go to Tehran just for the respect of Ayatollah Burujerdi. And until the end, I mean, Ayatollah Khomeini, he was a marja. He had his own Dars e Kharij, but look at how they wanted to keep that center. At the end, he had arranged his Dars e Kharij in a way that it finished before the Dars of Ayatollah Burujerdi, and all his students, they went and attended Ayatollah Burujerdi's class. And people told him, you are a manager, Ayatollah, why you come here? He said, no, we have to show that we all need Ayatollah Burujerdi, that he excels everyone else. Now, this is very important. We need someone in the center. Now, whether we run a country or we are a community without country, internationally, we need someone in the center. It's true, we can follow every Maharaja, any Maharaja that we wish, even in different fields. Now, of course, you may say, our Maharaja do not allow it now, that in different fields we follow different people. However, it may come about in the future. There is nothing theoretically against it, or in Sharia, that we bar, except that tradition that usually people have followed one person. And this tradition has come about, as I said, because of the importance of centrality of the Marja. Now, having this in mind, I mean, looking at it from both aspects, one man can hardly tackle. We need counselors and all these things. We need a center. We need a central power. Of course, when I say power, I don't mean corrupt power. I mean a power like Ayatollah Burujani's power, like Ayatollah Sistani's power, okay? Something like that. We need a center of power, and especially if we run a country, things become a bit different. Because then you have many marajas, but eventually the opinion of one marja should become law. You cannot have two laws, isn't it? You can say the followers of Ayatollah Burujani cannot pay, the followers of Ayatollah Sistani are allowed not to pay interest to what they borrow from banks, but the followers of such marja should pay. It's not possible. When you have a law, you have a law. You cannot have two laws. You cannot have double standards in law. So, when you run a country and you want to run it according to the opinions of the marja, then it becomes very different. I mean, this idea of, okay, anyone can refer to any marja they wish, is a bit modified to something a bit different, which I will talk about later. Now, this is a good reading. With regards to what I'm going to discuss, Modernization and Changing Perceptions of Islamic Law by David Bondyman. A short article. However, it gives us some idea about why we need urgently that aspect of the Shahad which deals with what the Prophet would have done rather than what the Prophet did, what the Prophet would have done in these circumstances. The traditional ijtihad is 90% based on what the Prophet did. 10%, 5%, even less, on what the Prophet would have done. Because the society had not changed so much. We didn't have that much difference between a society of the 18th century in Egypt or in Iran or in Pakistan, and the societies in the early days of Islam. However, when we come to 20th century, there's a drastic change. Now, when we talk about ijtihad, we talk, say, 60% about what the Prophet would have done in such situation, and 40% about what the Prophet did. And we are not really in need of that because it's all in the books. We need someone to retell it to us, that's right. But you see, we don't need to waste our capitals and our big figures as mujtahideen to spend the whole life to tell us, for example, whether something is mustahab or it's a ihtiyat wajib or slightly different. Whether you have to say three times subhanallah, alhamdulillah, wa la ilaha illallah, allahu akbar, or one time is sufficient. I mean, why should we spend all these capitals and wealth, the life of these people, just to tell us these things? We need them for more important issues. Now, I want to mention something which has become a sort of urgency in the Shi'i world especially, since one century ago, almost since one century ago, our scholars, our ulama, I'm not talking about lay people, because lay people always talk about these things. In my opinion, it's better to be that, like that. In my opinion, that's the way it should be. However, scholars do not talk on opinions, isn't it? They say, we, according to the sources, according to this. Since a century ago, our scholars, Shia scholars, have started to think about that, the role of that other chunk of Islam, what the Prophet would have done. And now, I give the history of that, and how they have tried to resolve it. You see, it's very easy to find what Prophet did, as I said, of course, when I say very easy, comparatively easy. But what the Prophet would have done, we need new methods. We need new system of ijtihad. We cannot use the old methods to find out what the Prophet would have done in certain situations. So they have been thinking about it, and one of the most explicit people in this is Shahid Botahari, who actually wrote and lectured in a time in Iran when we had we were at the peak of Westernization. So Western values were coming, Western science, Western technology, and Muslims thought, wow, can we really remain Muslims? Or we have to change. Now, one good thing about Shahid Mutahari, who was a student of course, Ayatollah Khomeini, was that he had a leg in both worlds, in the new modern world and in the old world. He taught in university, he taught in Hoza, and he was involved very intimately with the people who believed that, look, your books of fiqh cannot run the new world. Now, of course, Ayatollah Khomeini based his revolution on the fact that our book of fiqh can run the world. Islam can run the world today. And some people may say, I will just do our duties on worship, on ibadat. We have our madrasa in that. The modern world is going its way, and Islam is becoming more isolated and isolated as a private religion. Now, this was something which some of our ulama tacitly, not explicitly, believed in. And this is the idea Ayatollah Khomeini fought against vehemently, that no, we can run a country. We have theories for economy, we have theories for politics, we have theories for... And if you go through the discussions that people had, the ulama had against Ayatollah Khomeini, actually, they were saying, you are a great scholar, but how you want to run a country? It is not our job, or we do not have the means or ability to run a country. Now, you said that we should have one person at top, and then there are advisors, counselors, and all these things who advise. This was exactly what Ayatollah Khomeini was thinking. That we have to lead the values. However, of course, other people would do other things. This is how we can run a country. You have heard this very famous notion, or famous anecdote, that when he was imprisoned for the first time in 1957, I guess. It was 1957. Anyhow, I know the Iranian date, I cannot transfer it to English date. When he was arrested, the people who interrogated him, they were top officials, one of them told him, you are an Ayatollah, and you are holy. The holiness of religion should not be impurified, so to speak, should not be adulterated by politics. Politics is dirty. So how do you want, as a holy person, how do you want to come in the field of politics? He said, yes, I agree, your politics is dirty, but our politics is not going to be dirty. We have a different type of politics, and we will base our movement upon that. Now, let's move on. The question which was mainly in mind since the last century. I want to emphasize on this, since the last century, and especially because Shia was Iran was the center of Shia world, all these discussions actually were centered around events which did take place in Iran. Even the ulama in Iraq, you see that the ulama in Iraq, like Ahund Khorasani, like Muhammad Kazem Yazdi, they all had their ideas, their views, opinions around what happened in Iran. Now, in the constitutional revolution in Iran, something very new came to mind, did happen in Iran, and that was the parliament. We didn't have the idea of parliament in Islam, did we? Now, you may say, well, Islam is just equal to democracy, Islam doesn't have anything in common with democracy, Islam has parliament, but tell me one example from old books that talk about democracy and parliament. We didn't have parliament. Now, when in constitutional revolution, parliament was created in Iran, the ulama were divided. Some supported it, and some were against it. I will discuss about it a bit later, but for example, Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri is very famous alim scholar of Tehran. He was not a major, but very famous scholar. He argued that, what is this issue of parliament? What do you want to do? He said, we want to legislate laws. He said, what laws do you want to legislate? If it is laws of Islam, it's already legislated. If it's against Islam, different from Islam, we don't want it. So what do you want the parliament for? And this was strong arguments. However, he had not seen another aspect of it, isn't it? Now, these things which came about gave the idea that what should we do with these changes that the modern society is adopting with regards to Sharia? What does Sharia say about this? So the topic Sharia and social change, how Sharia is going to cope with social change. Now, Murtaza Mutahhari did put the question very eloquently, that he said that Sharia and society are against each other in their natures. Why? Because Sharia is a stagnant. Since Sharia is something that you have to find out from the past, from the Sunnah of the Prophet, from the Quran. And society, of course, this change was not there until a couple of centuries ago, is an ever-changing phenomenon. So, Sharia is fixed, irrevocable, and unchangeable. And society is fluid and ever-changing. So how these two, how Sharia can or would be able to control the society? Now, if we talk about an Islamic system, how could an Islamic system claim that it can remain Islamic and at the same time keep pace with social change? Now, you may say our Maraja issue fatwas about all these issues which in modern time comes about. However, when we move a bit further, you would see that it's not as easy as this, as what we think. Actually, we are in trouble. It's always too good to know we are in trouble. When we think that everything is fine and rosy, we are certainly caught by surprise. If we know that we are in trouble, then we think about it. And I tell you, as someone who has the experience of running a country, I mean, the knowledge how people are struggling to run a country according to Islam, I tell you, we are in trouble. We are really in trouble. And you will see how we are in trouble. Now, either it has to go be. So how could an Islamic system claim that it can remain Islamic and at the same time keep pace with social change? We have three solutions here. I will mention these three solutions, and then we go to question and answer, and we expand on this for next week, inshallah. So, the three solutions. Either it has to go beyond the boundaries of Sharia, so we have to just say, okay, put aside Sharia. Sharia is something which is which belongs to the past, and we have to have, we have parliament, we have scientists, we have scholars, and they tell us how to proceed. The second thing, make sure that the necessary changes are made only outside the realm of Sharia. Any change we want to bring in society, we keep the Sharia intact, and we follow the Sharia in those areas that Sharia has a ruling, and any change that we want to bring, we keep it outside the boundaries of Sharia. You will see that this is very difficult as well. This is very difficult. So if this is difficult, and if this is not an option for us, because we are Muslims, we want to follow Sharia, isn't it? We don't want to go beyond the boundaries of Sharia. So what else? What else remains? What else remains is to push the boundaries of Sharia to make it bigger. Isn't it? We make the Sharia bigger. And this is the duty of the mujtahids, to make the Sharia bigger. You may say, but isn't the Sharia what was laid down by Prophet Muhammad 1400 years ago? That was part of Sharia, we agree. But isn't ijtihad established to find out what are the rulings at every age of new issues? And when we give the new rulings, aren't we actually expanding the size of Sharia? We are, isn't it? So, yes. You say something.
I can pull my question. I was going to ask, what is Sharia?
Sharia is the system of law which is derived by ijtihad, which tell us what the Prophet, peace be upon him, did or said, the practice of the Prophet, how it was. So the Sharia is the system of Islam.
Sharia is from Allah. It's the system of law from Allah.
Yes, Sharia is from Allah.
So
yes.
Then rather than expanding Sharia, are we just discovering the new areas of Sharia that we didn't know?
That's a better way of putting it, probably, yeah. Discovering, well, you are saying the same thing. We make Sharia bigger. Because before we discover it, it's not there. Before we discover it, it's not there.
One implies invention, one implies reinterpretation or more study.
Not really reinterpretation. No, I'm not fond of reinterpretation.
Sorry, not reinterpretation, but one implies invention and man-made invention, and one implies just studying deeper. So that was my only question, because I was confused.
What is ijtihad? I mean, from the lessons that you had the last three sessions, what is ijtihad? Can someone just define what is ijtihad? Because this may answer your question.
So it's attempt to interpret the laws of God.
To interpret or to find out? To find out. Man's effort to find out the laws of God, isn't it? That's what we call ijtihad. But it's man's effort, isn't it? And therefore, ijtihad is always based on certain degree of doubt. We cannot say for certain that this is the ruling of God, isn't it? I mean, ijtihad is always based on certain degree of conjecture. Because when we say, according to this hadith, how do you know that this hadith is correct? Because my methodology says that it's correct. How deep you believe in your methodology? 80%. Isn't it? Not 100% sure about my methodology. And that's why the mujtahids always say, any ruling issued by a marja or by a mujtahid It is dhanni. It's based on certain degree of conjecture. We assume that a hadith having these criteria is correct. We assume. Because 80% it gives us surety. It gives us certainty. However, the 20% would remain doubtful. And it's because of that 20% that you get different rulings from different maraji, isn't it? You may say, why maraji issue different rulings? Because of that 20% of doubt. So they actually look at things from different angles. And whatever they ruling the issue is always has a room for doubts. Now, when I say we push the boundaries of Shaykh, the mushtahids do it. Discover it, of course, yes, with that 20% of doubt, yeah, they discover it. That's what I said. What would prophets, what he would have done? We want to discover what he would have done. But the point is, we discover it. We say it. Yes.
Therefore, Sharia is not fixed.
Absolutely. Yeah, bravo. This is what I wanted to come to. Sharia is not fixed.
It's not fixed. It's only fixed to how much knowledge we acquire or know of, or all the laws that we are aware of.
Actually, Sharia cannot be fixed because Sharia claims that it has rulings for everything. And everything hasn't come about yet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Everything is to come about, and therefore Sharia cannot be fixed. Yes?
Could you say that the Sharia is fixed, however its true extent or its true essence has not been yet identified?
I mean, you can say it in any language you like, but we know what that is.
No, I think, we talk of principles of Sharia where it's fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that is what you're trying to say, Muhammad, that the principles are fixed, but we cannot apply it fully to the life cycle because society is still fluid, therefore it needs help.
What do you mean by principles? You mean usul al-fiqh or what?
Yeah, I mean, you see, where we're saying principles, there's a certain golden rules that cannot change.
Yeah.
Okay?
Certain values, certain
yes.
golden rules. But if
therefore,
by principles we mean methodology may change.
Yes. They're probably what we would call is form the foundation.
Mm.
And then as society like is exploring or is coming into knowledge of different aspects, like you mentioned in science or finance, therefore, Sharia like has claims that it has a law for every aspect of life. Therefore, Sharia has to come and guide on that aspect of life, which has just been explored or newly found out.
Yeah.
See, if Sharia is to cover everything, and everything hasn't come yet, then new laws will be formed to cover those situations. Is it possible, within your understanding, that it can happen that one society, one country, has something new, another country has something equally new but different, such that Sharia is different depending on the locality within which the Muslim resides?
You cannot say Sharia is different. You can say that now they have explored one aspect of Sharia and these have explored another. Actually, if we say that the Sharia is like a circle, they have pushed this side a bit further out and this society has pushed this side a bit further out. But we cannot say that we have two Sharias. Or, of course, we may have two Sharias in the sense that two mujtahids may issue two different rulings based on that degree of conjecture, which always is there. Yeah. Now, do you think this is possible to do? Sorry, this one. Make sure that the necessary changes are made only outside the realm of Sharia. Or, in a better way, in a more extreme way actually, we keep society in the boundaries of Sharia all the time. We do not allow things to develop which requires new rulings. We do not allow it. We say, well, this was not there at the time of the prophets. We do not allow it. Therefore, we do not need new laws, isn't it? Is this going to be a successful method? Do you know who tried this? Well, Al-Sunnah is not a monolithic. To be fair on them, of course. Yeah. Taliban tried this in Afghanistan, isn't it? I don't blame them. That's the way they looked at Sharia, okay? They said, we want to keep society in the boundaries of Sharia. This was the Sharia. Nothing new, nothing like what we see nowadays was there. If there is something new, we need new ruling. That means outside Sharia. So we keep society inside Sharia. However, it doesn't work. Why it doesn't work? Because you cannot control the society. You see, even I argue with Taliban now. Okay, do you want hospital? Yes. There were doctors at the time of the Prophet. It was very good. Okay, now do you want to uproot diseases? Yes, of course. We want to uproot diseases. It was very good at the time of the Prophet. Now, if you uproot diseases, then you have population explosion. What do you want to do with it? Birth control? No. We don't want birth control because there was nothing like that at the time of the Prophet. You cannot contain it. If you uproot the disease, you need birth control. Isn't it? If you want to industrialize your country, you have a worker class or working class. Then working class has its own needs and needs its own rules. You cannot industrialize and say you want to keep that inside the Sharia. Unless you say we just want to live in a village. This is what actually Imam Khomeini wrote to one of the scholars who had criticized him with regards to some rules. He said, according to what you say, this was one of the most prominent students of him, who was a member of his Council of Fatwa. Actually, the fatwas of Ayatollah Khomeini was issued by his staff, this man, who criticized him. And he criticized him about chess. He said, some of the rulings you give is not what we find in Sharia. And he made the example of chess, but went to other social rulings. And then Imam Khomeini wrote to him, I'm very sorry about your understanding of Sharia. Now, he was a member of his fatwa council. I'm very sorry about your understanding of Sharia. According to your understanding, Muslims have to leave cities and have to go to villages and forests and live there, so that they can keep a society in pace with Sharia, according to your understanding of Sharia. So that means, you see, there were very serious discussions on this. We will come to these discussions. That's why I say we are in trouble. We are in trouble. I mean, if big ulama, like a member, Ayatollah Qadir, his name was, because this is public, we can talk about it, if he did not understand the viewpoint of Ayatollah Khomeini on Sharia, then we are in trouble. Now, even go beyond that, Ayatollah Khomeini didn't understand it. And when Imam issued a ruling, he came to Friday prayer and said, Imam did not mean this, he meant that. Because everyone criticized Imam Khomeini on that issue. He wanted just to cool down the Qom and Najaf and Ulama and, wow, don't make you and cry. Imam didn't mean this. We'll discuss this. And next morning, Imam wrote a letter. I'm sorry, you misunderstood me. I exactly meant that. So that's why I say, I mean, if Ulama cannot somehow sort this among themselves, that means we are in trouble. However, it's a good trouble. It's a good trouble. It gives us a sort of platform to dive ahead. Yes.
His second point, make sure that the necessary changes are made only outside the realm of Sharia.
The traditional Sharia. This is
so this is referring to
the Sharia that we have in books.
So any new issues
we don't allow it.
We don't not only don't we allow it, we don't even entertain the we don't give fatwas or anything.
The fatwa would be haram. Yes. We don't allow it because it's outside the boundaries. No, sorry. What we mean by this, I will explain what I mean by this, that there are certain things which are not discussed by Sharia at all. Okay? And we allow only changes in that. Like, for example, the...
Isn't it like the French Revolution?
No, no. Like the laws of traffic lights. Traffic.
Okay.
I mean, Sharia doesn't really care about how you drive, is it?
Yes,
of course it cares,
yes,
but there is nothing in Sharia you find. So, if there's any change in society, we make sure that it happens in that area, not anything which is related to Sharia, like Parliament, for example. Parliament clashes with Sharia, isn't it?
Yes.
You want to legislate? Legislation is the right of God only, isn't it? So, this clashes, okay? So, we make sure that any change happens outside this clashing area.
If it becomes socially very difficult.
We'll discuss it.
Yes.
We'll discuss it, inshallah.
It's Ahl-Sunnah, they don't have jihad anymore. What do they call?
Ahl-Sunnah, actually these discussions were somehow started by Ahl-Sunnah, especially in Egypt. Egypt is a very interesting country because Egypt was the sort of interface of Islam with the West. However, they did not develop it. And because they didn't have this idea of deep ijtihad, like what we have in Shia, they did not actually, we have people like Sayyid Qutb, for example, or people like Abdullah Huri, they actually started to discuss these issues. But it did not develop, because they didn't have, as I said, that sort of deep idea of ijtihad that we have in Shia, they did not develop it further. However, now that you have an Islamic group ruling Egypt, they need to tackle these issues. And soon you would see that. Soon you would see that they have the same problems as that, for example, we had in Iran. About how to run a country with Sharia. Yeah.
My question is, all of these issues which you've raised, how does it go back to our core understanding that all Sharia is either comes from the Prophet or our Imam, in other words, our 14 Masjid and the 12 Imams, who guided us after...
Yeah, it comes from them, but through what?
So this is my question, that from my understanding, it's either come from the Prophet directly, the Sunnah, as we say. After the Prophet passed away, the Sunnah wal Jama'ah were put in that situation where they were deriving their own opinions from, you know, from the sources that were there and making the mistakes that they've done today. We didn't take that path. We followed the 12 Imams. Now, the living Imam at the moment has told us through hadith that we have been told that the issues that are going to change in the world, for the social issues, the new technology which comes up, the core, the Sharia which you don't need to refer to these issues, which is fixed, as you mentioned, the traditional Sharia, that is there. The fluid part of it, which you're saying that's ever-changing, if our mujtahid are going wrong in those particular issues, surely it's not our job to inform them. It's the Imam's job.
Of course, I'm not telling that this is our job. This is mujtahidin's job. You see, the Imam has referred us to mujtahidin, isn't it? Okay. Now, we are telling how mujtahidin should proceed. Not that how we should proceed. This is not our job. Because we are talking about Masjaiya and Ijtihad, isn't it?
Are you saying that they are in a dilemma at the moment as to how they should...
I'm saying that they are in trouble. We follow them. Okay. We're not in trouble. Alhamdulillah, we don't have knowledge. Thanks, God. You see? They are in trouble. The Mujtahideen are in trouble. Okay? And now we try to find out what solutions they have tried to put forward to solve that problem. Is that clear?
Yes.
All right. If there's no more question, we stop here.
Sure.